Hello and welcome to Comic Talk Today, and this is going to be finally my catch-up episode on all the comics that I've been reading over the last few weeks. Now, this discussion will not include the books that came out this past week on October 10th, but it will include books from the last couple of weeks of September and the first week of October, because there was a bunch, and I missed that bunch of recordings during that session, so I figured, you know what? I'm going to catch up and talk about some of these books because they were actually really quite good. There were some interesting things that came out over the course of those last few weeks. Now, if you want to hear what I think about the books that came out this past week on October 10th, I'll be doing Top of the Pile on Tuesday because Monday I have a special topic that I want to discuss, and I think it's a pretty serious one, so stay tuned for that. I'll mention what it is at the end of the episode. So, without further ado, let's talk about some comics. And I want to kick things off talking about Low Road West number 1. This is a book from Boom Studios, written by Philip Kennedy Johnson, with art by Flaviano, colors by Miguel Muerto, and letters by Jim Campbell. And now this is a really interesting read. If you haven't checked this out, I recommend you pick it up. I think at first, some people might be turned off by the story for the simple fact that the book is kind of a post-apocalyptic story. And there's actually a couple of those that I'll be talking about on this episode. But this one kicks off that way. It seems like there has been a major war. The majority of the United States has been decimated. But there is an interesting twist at the end of the issue. Well, we're kind of towards the end of the issue. That I think means that this book will not necessarily be exactly what we think it is. And I think that's interesting because that's kind of how the characters feel about the way that this world works. And I found that fascinating. So when the story kicks off, we have a group of kids. There's five different kids. They're on a school bus traveling through the desert. And we get a little bit of setup about what this whole world is about. It seems like they're either listening to the radio or maybe something's being recounted that led to the events of this bus trip. And as the kids are going through the desert, we see a sign that has the distance to both Amarillo and Albuquerque, and Amarillo has been crossed out. And there's smoke everywhere. And as we learn, it's from different gas pumping drills throughout the desert. And it seems like they've been catching fire. In fact, all of the drilling rigs around the country have, for some reason, caught on fire. And things are not very good. Things are not very good. What exactly the event that led to all this, we don't know. There's some hints, I think, that are mentioned on what exactly is happening. But a lot of people are fleeing from the East Coast out west. These kids are actually on their way to San Francisco, if I'm not mistaken. And they're trying to go to Low Road West, I guess is the name of the place. And it seems to be a refugee camp, maybe one of the few remaining places in the country where they actually haven't been heavily impacted by this war. And we learn a lot about that. Of course, everything seems to be a little militaristic, at least in what we hear over the radio. And you know, people say, hey, you know, stay true. You know, you're on this deportee journey and, you know, be faithful to the cause and all that and the other. And some of the kids definitely feel that way because it seems at least a couple of the kids' parents were enlisted to join the war effort. And there's not a whole lot of that, but we do get to see that. Now, halfway through this trip, the bus driver stops the bus in the middle of nowhere, just gets out, grabs his bike, and starts biking off. And the kids get out, and they're like, what the hell's going on? Where are you going? You can't leave. But he just keeps on riding. And, of course, it's not a great place to be in because they're in the middle of the desert, somewhere, I would assume, in New Mexico, based on the signs. It's on 40 West, Interstate 40. And they're like, well, what the hell do we do? Does anybody know how to drive a bus? Because they're all kids. And one of the kids is actually old enough to know how to drive, but he says that the problem is that the bus is out of gas. So now they have to find a way to get to Low Road West. And along the way, they meet some unsavory characters. So I talked about this briefly, and I said it was a little bit Mad Max-y in the way that the description was. And it does seem that way. They meet a gang that's out in the desert, and they're very much Mad Max-y. In, you know, leather pants and the hockey mask and whatever. And, they're ready to rob these kids and kill them. But something happens and the kids manage to escape and they escape into this house that mysteriously wasn't there before, but now it is. And they're looking outside and it seems like the stuff that's outside isn't really the stuff that they saw while they were out there escaping this gang. So that's pretty interesting. It seems like there's a little interesting turn of events where there may be some supernatural stuff going on. So we do see what looks to be some monsters. In fact, while the kids are trying to get away, one of the kids winds up finding a dead, I'm assuming deer, could be a different animal. You know what? It's a little bit bigger than a deer. So maybe a moose. and touches it, and the moose comes to life and goes to attack him, but they knock the moose out and he dies again. So there's definitely a lot of weird stuff going on, and I think it's really quite interesting. This is definitely a first issue with a lot of setup, but I think one that has a really intriguing ending, and that definitely will have me coming back to check out the second issue. So highly, highly recommend Lode Road West. I think this could be a really interesting book if you're looking to try something a little different, something a little bit more offbeat. I'm going to give this one a 4 out of 5. Really enjoyed it. Quite a good book. Let's go on over to DC and talk about Justice League Odyssey number 1, a book that I've been anticipating for quite a while. And I had a lot of thoughts when I first read this book. I wasn't sure what to think about it, but I enjoyed the actual journey going through it. We kick things off with Jessica Cruz. She's been sent by the Justice League to go out to the Ghost Sector in space. And there's a lot of tie-in with this book to the events of Dark Knight's Metal and Justice League No Justice. So I think the problem that I had with this issue is if you didn't read it, which I did, but didn't quite enjoy either one of those. If you didn't read it, then you might be a little lost as to what's going on. You may not know how it is that Jessica got here, why it is that this Ghost Sector thing is around, why these worlds were shrunken and then unshrunken in the Ghost Sector. But I think overall they did a pretty good job of kind of trying to explain it. This is, of course, written by Josh Williamson. We've got art by Steven Sejic, letters by Darren Bennett. I think Sejic colors his own work because there's no colorist listed on here. But really quite interesting. So as Jessica's trying to go through these sentry points that the Guardians have placed to guard the Ghost Sectors from invaders, there's weird stuff happening. There's like this electrical storm with weird beasts floating around it, and we see a ship coming out of nowhere. And in the ship is Cyborg and Starfire. And we see a little back and forth between Cyborg and Starfire trying to figure out where it is that they're trying to go. We learn a little bit about how they got here. Not really entirely know what's going on. But it seems like Cyborg's mother box has been calling to him. And why that is, we don't know. Unless, of course, you know a little bit about this book, you may know another character that's going to be popping into this. And I'll get to that in a second. But they're talking about, you know, the Ghost Sector is a dangerous place. They try to get out of there as quickly as possible. And Jessica gets a warning from her ring. Hey, there's intruders in the premises. So she goes and sees Brainiac's ship. And she's like, well, why the hell is Brainiac here? He's not supposed to be here. So she's like, hey, stop your ship. You know, I'm going to arrest you. And that's when we learn that, hey, Cyborg's in here. Starfire's in here. So Starfire goes out because the storm is about to surge and that will kill Jessica because even her Green Lantern powers won't be able to protect her. So she goes and rescues Jessica, brings her into the ship, and Jessica's like, what the hell are you guys doing here? The Justice League didn't tell me that you guys were coming. And Cyborg's like, well, the Justice League doesn't know. This is not Justice League business. You know, I have this call from the Mother Box. I need to see what's going on past the Ghost Sector. And at that point, they get attacked by these monsters. Starfire manages to use her powers to give Cyborg extra strength, and that makes the ship that they're on go even faster. So they manage to get out of there. We get to meet Azrael. He's there. And Azrael is, of course, a little crazy. And, you know, Cyborg's like, hey, what are the voices telling you? And the voices are pretty much saying, like, don't trust the robot and the girl. They're going to get you killed. And he's like, oh, he's just saying that, you know, we're in a dangerous place. We got to get out of here quickly. And I like that. As you guys know that listen to this podcast, I'm a big Azrael fan. I've talked about Azrael quite a bit lately, and I'm really happy to see him in a book. So the costume change is actually quite good. I like it quite a bit. It's very reminiscent of when Jean-Paul took over the Bat-Cowl back in the early 90s, but very much modern. It's got a lot of red and yellow and black. I think it's a really good look. And he still has the bat symbol on there, which, I mean, I understand why, but it kind of seems almost unnecessary to me. Anyways, that's the design they chose, so that's fine. Well, they end up getting to the planet that is calling them, and who is there but Darkseid? And of course, if you know anything about this book, you know that was going to be the case, because Darkseid has been shown in all the promotions for this. And he's like, yeah, I'm the one that called you here, and they're like, Darkseid, I can't believe it. Like, we're going to kick your, you know what? And he's like, no. He's like, you're here for a reason, and the reason is that these people need you. And then we learn that these people worshipped Jessica and Azrael and Cyborg and Starfire as gods. And I thought that was curious because, you know, these cultures are thousands of years old and these characters are not. And, you know, what exactly is going on is uncertain yet. I'm sure we'll find out as the series progresses. But I thought it was rather curious and pretty well executed. Now, of course, there, you know, this is all a multiverse thing. So it could be that maybe at some point there were characters similar to these, or there was some kind of, I don't know, time dilation thing. Who knows? But I found it curious. The art is quite beautiful. I think the story lacks in some places, but I thought it was really quite enjoyable. And I'm looking forward to see this this newly designed Darkseid. I like the new costume, but we'll see how it goes. So if I'm going to rate this one up, Justice League Odyssey number 1 is going to get a 3.5 out of 5. From there, I move on over to Image Comics and talk about Blackbird number 1. This is the brand new book by Sam Humphries with art by Jen Bartel. We've got colors by Nayoung Wilson and Jen Bartel, letters by Jody Nguyen, and design by Dylan Todd. Now, this is a book that I've been looking forward to because, you know, the synopsis got me a little curious. It was about a girl who kind of knows that magic exists, but nobody really believes her. And as I started reading the book, I almost felt like, I'm not sure if this is a book for me. But as the story progressed, I actually got pretty engrossed in it and thought it was quite interesting the way that the whole thing was done. Now, Jen's art is, of course, a little more cartoony, and I thought that was an interesting choice for the type of subject matter this book deals with. But it works really well. I will say, if you are familiar with Sam Humphries and you know the stuff that he did over at Green Lanterns, you may be familiar with this kind of story. I thought that was a curious thing. And I wonder if the original idea for this book, or at least maybe even the main character, didn't stem from some of the stuff that Humphries was dealing with in the Green Lanterns title. Because once you get, I don't know, about a third of the way through this book, maybe even a little less than that, the main character seems awfully familiar in that she has a lot of mental issues. And it reminded me a little bit of the stuff that he did when he was doing that Green Lanterns book. Now, the girl, of course, has a lot of trauma that she's dealing with, so she's really messed up, right? And the way the story is structured, it kind of happens in two different time frames. So you see stuff that happens in the past. In fact, the book begins 10 years in the past, where there was this earthquake in the town that she lives in. And there was a lot of trauma, a lot of commotion, a lot of death and destruction. But something happened, and people began forgetting some of these bad things. In fact, there's one scene where this monster appears, and then this magical lady appears and is going around to all the people and says, "Forget." And they say, "I forget." And she goes to the next one, "Forget." She says, "I forget." But when it gets to her, she says, "I forget." But then she explicitly says, "But I didn't forget." Because it seems like there is some kind of magical connection here where she can see these things and other people can't. And of course, these leads are kind of in a dark path, and there's other things that happen. You know, her parents didn't have a very good relationship. Her dad ends up leaving. Her mom ends up dying in a car crash after their parents kind of split up. So we get back to the present day, and she hasn't really had a good life. She's down on her luck. She lives with her sister. Her sister seems to have kind of her crap together, and she doesn't. She pops a lot of pills. She's drunk all the time. She works at a bar. And we get to see some of that stuff. In fact, her attitude itself, she's got a terrible attitude towards life, and I can understand why. Right, because she's had all this bad stuff happen to her. But still, she doesn't really feel like there's any way to better herself. And so she's just kind of stuck in this place and blames everybody for everything. In fact, the next book I'm going to talk about is similar in that regards. One night she's working at the bar that she works at, and the guy is talking to her, kind of hitting on her. And she's like, "Look, douchebag, I don't care. I don't want to talk to you." Her boss comes in, he's like, "Hey, somebody dumped a bunch of trash in the back, so she's got to go back there and shovel it." And as that's happening, she finds this bracelet in a gem. She's like, "Huh, these are magical gems." And it's a magical bracelet. And she looks up and sees the guy that was hitting on her in this like sorcerer outfit going through a portal. And he's like, "You shouldn't see this." Goes through it. And she's like, "Oh my God, I knew it was real. I knew I wasn't imagining things." So she tries to go and grab the guy, and her sister shows up. She's like, "I found your pills, this, that, and the other." And as all this is happening, the monster that originally showed up after the earthquake comes in, and she's like, "See, I told you. I told you that the monsters were real." And the monster grabs the sister and takes her back through a portal. And she's like, "Oh my God, the monster's going to kill my sister?" And that's kind of where the book ends. So there's a lot of setup, I think I wonder what the audience is for this. And to be honest, I'm not sure the demographic for this book is really the typical comic book demographic. But if you really want to try something different that delves a lot into mental health issues, and I know that's kind of a hot subject right now, a lot of books are dealing with that kind of thing, then this could definitely be a book for you. Like I said, I'm not sure this will have a wide appeal for comic readers, but I think definitely reviewers eat this kind of stuff up, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really well executed. The character is not likable, so I felt like it was hard to read parts of this at some points, but overall, I dug it, and I hope we dive a little more into this magical realm of the Blackbird, because she's obviously got some kind of abilities, and maybe her sister does as well. And since we're on there, I want to talk about Fearscape number 1 from Vault Comics. This is written by Ryan O'Sullivan with one of my favorite artists right now, Andrea Moody. We've got colors by Vladimir Popov and letters by And World Design. And this is also a book that's very different, and a book that I think very few publishers would actually be willing to give a shot. I was listening to the Geek Brunch podcast this past week, and Mike was saying how this book is a little pretentious, and it totally is. It totally is. I dug the style of storytelling, though, because in many ways, this book is almost written like gothic romance story, I guess, in some way, of like the late 1800s, around that era. And it was fascinating. It's something that I haven't read in a comic previously. Now, I mean, you know, if you've ever taken an English class, maybe not so much high school, although I'm sure there's some of that, but that's been so long I don't remember. You know, I took a lot of college English courses because I was an English major, and I had to read a lot of this kind of stuff, you know, like Emily Bronte and things like that. The tone of it is very much that, except the story takes place in modern times. And basically it has this guy, I believe his name is Henry Henry, which is really weird, but that's what he calls himself at one point. And, so there's this guy, he's a writer, except apparently not a very good writer, and also a really crappy person, So he's having a meeting with his agent, and his agent's like, "I'm not your agent. You're a charity case. I'm here doing a favor to Arthur." Arthur is Henry's best friend, who is an extremely successful fantasy writer. He's got, you know, like 20, I think 21 books is what they said that he wrote. He's writing more now. And, you know, he's Arthur's agent. But because he and Arthur are really good friends, he feels kind of like, okay, I'm going to do Arthur a favor and hear this Henry guy out. Well, Henry is trying to be a writer, except he's not a very good writer. He currently is doing like translation work for other works. Except apparently he's not very good at that either, because when he tries to translate stuff, he adds stuff to the story that wasn't in the original. And so, of course, he has issue getting his translations published because the publishers are like, this is not what the work is about. It's about this other thing, and this guy is adding this extra stuff, which I thought was really fascinating, because I do know a little bit about translation work in literature, and that's not necessarily out of the ordinary. Now, you know, they don't show examples of what exactly he's doing, but there's always, you know, when you translate from one language to another, there's a lot that goes into trying to grab the intricacies of the original language, right? Because there's certain things that don't translate, right? Like, you may be able to translate words, but you can't really translate the meaning of those words, right? Like, there'd be phrases or sayings in a particular language that when you translate them literally don't make sense in the new language, but make perfect sense in the original, right? Lots of idioms and metaphors, things like that. Obviously, this guy's doing a little bit more than that because the publishers are catching it. And the weird thing is, I mean, this guy is so high on himself that he feels like everybody is below him and that they don't understand the greatness that is him. And, you know, there are people like that in the real world. There's tons of people like that in the real world. We get a lot of that nowadays. And so I definitely could relate to that kind of thing. And he's definitely not a likable main character. And he gets less and less likable as he goes on. In fact, after the meeting, he goes to Arthur's house and finds one of the manuscripts that Arthur had been working on. And he steals it. He puts it in his pocket. And just as that happens, Arthur's daughter walks in and she's like, "Quit coming here and stealing crap from my dad." It's like, "I don't even understand why he's your friend. Like, you're a terrible person. Nobody likes you. Just, like, get the hell out." And he's like, I wasn't even stealing the book. He's like, what is it that he says? He's like, I picked it up and I was going to read a couple pages. And then she walked in and I put it away so she wouldn't yell at me. Like, how dare she say I stole it? I wasn't stealing it. It was hilarious. But, you know, he does come up extremely pretentious. It's very true. But like I said, there are people like this. And so that's why I found that fascinating. I love seeing this kind of thing in literature, right? And so when it happens in comics, I get surprised a lot of times because it doesn't happen very often. In fact, this book reads a lot like it was originally written as a novel and then somehow translated into a comic. But really well done, though. Really well done. As we keep going and he's trying to leave Arthur's house, he hears a sound and he opens the door and there's this like beautiful golden lady and she's like, I need you to come with me to the Fearscape to face humanity's fears. And he's like, what do you mean? He's like, I'm looking for, you know, every generation I find the greatest writer and I bring him to the Fearscape to battle humanity's fears. And you're Arthur, right? You need to come with me. You're the greatest writer of the time. And he's like, yeah, of course I'm Arthur. Like, let's go. And we all know he's not, right? And this whole time he's like saying bad things about her and about other people because he can't really live with himself being such a terrible person. And so he goes through to the Fearscape. He goes to the portal. And we learned a little bit about what the Fearscape is. I thought it was pretty interesting the way that it was explained. It almost reminded me a little bit of like Fables, for example, or the current Sandman book that came out a few weeks ago, The Dreaming. Really, really interesting stuff because it almost deals with the same kind of idea. In the Fearscape, humanity's fears come to life and the Fearscape and our reality are tied very closely together. So whenever a particular fear is conquered in the Fearscape, it loses power of itself in reality. And the example they give is a rat. So they're walking through this forest and a rat shows up and she's like, yeah, this is one of humanity's greatest fears. And he's like, well, it's just a rat. Like, what's the big deal? But then we see that, you know, during the Middle Ages, it was this giant spiky rat looking thing. And, the fear was of the plague. And, this writer came in. He was brought in as the greatest writer of that time to slay the fear of the plague. And as a result, immediately after that happened, the cure for the plague was discovered. And that led to the Renaissance. And the way that whole thing was done is, of course, you know, a little liberal, because the writer is, Petrarch, who was a writer of the time, and his work did usher in the Renaissance, but he actually died of the plague in reality, in our world, in real life. And in this world, he kind of didn't. And the way that they explain it is he became so engrossed with the story, he was kind of stuck in the Fearscape. And so I guess that's kind of how they explain the death. So he's still there. And it's really sad because he's like, oh my God, Laura, my love, talking to this golden woman. And she just doesn't talk to him. And she's like, it's really sad. Like he just became so engrossed in his story that he never left. And so I thought it was really curious. There's a lot of interesting things in this book, that I quite enjoy. I think it will definitely read a little pretentious to many people. But, if you're a lover of literature of any era, then I think this will be something to really watch out for. I think this could end up being a really fascinating story if taken in the right direction. In many ways, it reminds me a little bit of the Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler book, Her Infernal Descent, where it plays a lot with literary figures, but I really, really enjoyed it. So that is Fearscape number 1 from Vault Comics. I'm going to give this one a 5 out of 5. It was freaking good. Really, really good. On to Marvel, let's talk about Superior Octopus number 1, written by Christos Gage, with art by Mike Hawthorne, inks by Wade Van Grudbadger, man, that was a hard one, and colors by Jody Belair, letters by Clayton Cowles. Now, I was really excited for this book because I love Superior Spider-Man, right? When Doc Ock took over the body of Peter Parker, it was Doc's brain in Peter's body. This is a little bit different, and to be honest, I was a little lost. But I still want to talk about the book because I thought it was actually quite interesting. There's a lot happening, but the problem with this book is that there is a lot of background material, both backwards in time and forwards in time, that you need to be aware of in order to really grasp the whole story. Now, when the story kicks off, it seems pretty straightforward. So Doc Ock has gone to San Francisco another San Francisco story. He's gone to San Francisco. He's decided to become the sworn protector of San Francisco, and he stops a bunch of like bank robbers. Who's there? Like the Brothers Grimm and a few other people. Waxman, and decides not to apprehend them. He's like, "Look, I'm going to give you the opportunity. You can either go to jail or you can become a henchman." And they're like, "Well, does that mean we're good guys now?" Like they don't really know what's going on, and I don't think we as the reader know what's going on. But that was interesting. So it kicks off a little bit kind of like a typical Spider-Man heist story, but things change pretty quickly because we get to meet several characters from Secret Empire, which I thought was odd, but of course makes sense because Superior Octopus comes from that world. And, you know, they're like, "Hey, once you're in Hydra, you never leave Hydra." And I was like, "Well, this took a turn really quick," and it did, but it was interesting. So he's there. There's a couple of the characters I can't remember. Doc Ock has a fight and ends up pretending to be turned into stone by the Gorgon. And it turns out that he didn't. He kind of does like this instant cloning thing, which was really weird. And as it turns out, that really weird instant cloning thing is a callback directly to the Inheritors from the original Spider-Verse story. The Inheritors. Whew! I had to say that three times. From the original Spider-Verse story, which of course is important because now we have kicked off into Edge of Spider-Verse and the Inheritors are returning. So basically what happened is when this whole thing happened with Spider-Verse, he somehow memorized the plans for the Inheritors cloning machine, cloning technology. So they had far superior technology and he's able to basically instantly push his mind from one clone to another without any kind of repercussion and, you know, basically rendering him immortal. And that's when things got really weird, right? Because I was expecting something a little more grounded than what this ended up being. And I find myself having a tough time talking about it because there were so many connections to so many different things. I almost feel like unless you are a real Marvel person that has read all this stuff, you may be a little lost as to what's happening. However, the execution of the book is really good. And I like this really weird new Doc Ock, who's not really Doc Ock. He's actually also a clone of Doc Ock. I don't know. There's a whole lot of stuff going on. Christos Gage is a fantastic writer and he can definitely do some really intricate storytelling. But I think this one might be confusing to a lot of folks. I mean, I was confused and I've read all this stuff. So maybe I should go back and reread it and then look at this again. I don't know. I just feel like for a number one issue, some of the stuff shouldn't have to happen, right? Like they do an okay job at explaining some of the events that led to this, but they all happen within, you know, dialogue between two characters. So it's just like a one panel, two panel thing. And oftentimes for the amount of things that happen here, it's not enough to really get you caught up to speed. So really when I started first reading this, the book ended up being something completely different by the end of it. And I dug it. I dug it. This octopus, Superior Octopus guy, he doesn't seem like the greatest person, but he may have good intentions, right? Because he wants to break out of being known as a Hydra agent. In fact, there's a scene in there where he rescues, some cars from a bridge that was being destroyed, or collapsed, maybe partially collapsed. And he's talking to the cop or the fireman. He's like, "Yeah, make sure you get a better contractor next time because he did this and this wrong with the bridge building." And the guy's like, "Look, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't care about any of that stuff." He's like, weren't you like a Hydra guy?" And he's like, "You know, even if you were, whatever, it doesn't matter. Like you saved these people. You're okay in my book." And so I get that, but it almost felt a little glossed over. Overall, really enjoyed it though. I almost want this to be, you know what would be really cool is if eventually this does become kind of a villain book, and I could see some similarities to like Dr. Doom, for example, where Doom doesn't necessarily feel like the things that he does are bad, because really he's out to help his people, his country, and the Superior Octopus seems to be that way now. In particular, the fact that he's hiring these quote-unquote villains, these bad guys, these bank robbers, to be his henchmen. I wonder if maybe he doesn't feel like society isn't in a good place and the best option is for him to take over because of his superior intellect and technology. Anyways, at the end, there's a nice story that, you know, ties this directly into Age of Spider-Geddon. And I thought that was well done as well. And of course, I look forward to checking out Edge of Sparta again. I read the first issue that came out. I enjoyed it. I'm not going to talk about it today. But this was an interesting one. I'm going to give it a 3 out of 5 just for the fact of the amount of back matter that you need to read and understand to really fully grasp the story. But overall, really quite enjoyable. And, you know, the problem could become that Superior Octopus has just so much tech that he can pretty much MacGuffin himself out of anything. And he MacGuffins himself out of quite a few situations in this issue. So I'm holding my breath on it, but I really, really dug it. So again, 3 out of 5 for Superior Octopus #1. Still in Marvel, X-Men Black Magneto #1, written by the one and only Chris Claremont, with pencils by Dalibor Telesic. We've got inks by Roberto Poggi and Bilardino Bravo, colors by Donald Sanchez Almaro, and letters by Joe Caramagna. And this was great. It was great. I love me some Chris Claremont. If you remember reading X-Men back in the 80s into the 90s, you will most likely also remember Claremont being an amazing writer. And I think I was concerned about this because it's a one shot, and Claremont's a fantastic writer for those long term stories. But I love the setting of this. Basically, Magneto shows up at this diner, and he forms a bond with the waitress there, who's very young. It seems like it's a family business. They've run this diner for many generations. Her family has been in the military for many generations. Her mom wanted to be an astronaut at one point, but she was killed in action overseas, in a war. And, you know, that's kind of how the two form a bond, because she sees his tattoo and she's like, oh my God, you were in the Holocaust. And he's like, yeah, I was in Auschwitz. And so we learn a lot about them. There's, of course, a crew there that are not of the same mindset. Because in the news, we get to learn a little bit about these internment camps that are being set up by the government to grab mutants. And this is a storyline that we've had with the X-Men for 40 years now. I don't know. It's been so long. But interestingly, it works. And it works very well, in particular with the way things are nowadays politically. And I'll be talking maybe a little bit about that on tomorrow's episode. I don't want to spoil it. I'll tell you what it is at the end. But I think Claremont really, Claremont knows Magneto, right? He knows these characters. You know, Nanny shows up in here. We get, Asteroid M up in space where Magneto's training. So he's been preparing for this thing. And the reason he's at this diner is he's on his way to one of these, internment camps that actually ends up having only mutant children. Of course, another event taken pretty much out of current news. So, really, really well done. When he gets there, they don't recognize him at first, but immediately they do, and they're like, oh my God, that's Magneto. They send this soldier out in a Sentinel armor. It's not an actual Sentinel, it's a soldier in armor, kind of like Iron Man would be. And they duke it out. Magneto makes pretty quick work of her. But we learn a lot about this group. You know, they're gaining a lot of power within the United States. And Magneto's trying to reassemble a group to kind of go against all this hatred against mutants. You know, nothing new, right? This has been Magneto's thing for quite a long time. But it works based on current events. And it's something that I think, you know, X-Men has always been a direct extension of what's happening around us, right? When all the mutant hatred thing in the X-Men was coming out, I mean, that was at a time where that was a thing in real life. And again, it's pertinent now. But really, really good. It's obviously a setup for a much larger story, and what that story is, we don't know yet. I know there's been rumors of Claremont actually getting his own X-Men book. I would love it if it was an X team led by Magneto. I mean, I think, of course, it would be a direct extension of this particular issue. But I'm really digging these X-Men Black one-shots. This one in particular, I think, was fantastic. And there was an Apocalypse story at the end that I'm not going to talk about. I just wanted to talk about the Magneto segment of it. Really, really quite good. So I'm going to rate this one a 4 out of 5. A little bit of an odder book that I'll talk about is from Image Comics, and that is Juke Joint #1, written by T. Franklin with art by Aletha Martinez, colors by Shari Shankama, letters by Taylor Esposito, or as I like to say on the Valiant Central podcast, Esposito. I'm not going to sing because I'm a terrible singer. But yeah, this is really interesting. I talked earlier about, I wonder who the audience for this book is when I was talking about Blackbird. I almost also wonder that for this book. this almost seems like one of those books that will be like a Harvey Award winner or whatever, you know, something that people in the industry really love. But I'm not sure that this is going to be a big seller, in particular because of the subject matter that's discussed in the book. So basically, it's set in New Orleans, which of course you guys know I love, because what happens in New Orleans generally is voodoo, and I love voodoo magic stuff. I've always been a fan of those kind of stories. I think something that isn't done enough in comics. There's some great movies and great TV that deal with voodoo magic, but you know, not so much in comics. We do have one. There's a House of Whisper over at Vertigo. That's the new Sandman Universe book. Of course, the Shadow Man over at Valiant. But outside of that, not a whole lot of this. And we meet Mahalia, who is a voodoo priestess, and we get to know a little bit about the world, right? There's this this bar that she hangs out with other women, and there's a lot of signs in there, right? No touching, like be kind to other people. And it's a place where people can have fun and have a good time and not feel like they're going to be accosted by anybody, harassed by anybody. Well, you know, there's always that one douchebag, and there is a douchebag in here, and it ends up not being good, because as we learn, Mahalia's maybe a vampire, definitely some kind of monster, and ends up eating this guy. And as we continue on, there's a lot of this voodoo magic stuff of, you know, women being brought into Mahalia's circle as protection. The latter half of the book, or the latter third of the book, deals with the story of a woman who comes to Mahalia because her husband's beating her and her kid. And Mahalia's like, well, you know, I can fix it for you. And she's like, oh my God, he sucks. Like, I can't believe it. Just do something bad to him. This, that, and the other. Like, maybe kill him. She's like, are you sure? She's like, yeah, just kill him. And so that may or may not happen in the book. He maybe turned into a tree. I don't know. Spoiler alert. But really interesting stuff. What I found interesting too is the fact that this book has a disclaimer at the beginning of the story. In fact, it says, trigger warning. The content behind this page may consider triggering and sensitive material, domestic violence, sexual harassment, sexual assault, and abuse of some of the topics mentioned in Juke Joint. Please use your discretion in choosing to read this series. If you're feeling triggered by the content, please know that there are resources available for you. And it's got numbers for the National Domestic Violence Hotline, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, Women's Shelter, et cetera, et cetera. You are not alone. I thought that was really interesting. Really interesting. You know, there's another hot topic that's been coming up in society nowadays, where with the whole Me Too movement, for example, where people don't need to be afraid to report this kind of stuff. And I thought it was interesting that it would actually end up being in a comic book. I think the story maybe had some issues pacing-wise. I think maybe some of that has to do with the fact that we're learning a lot about how this world works in this first issue. But it's definitely very empowering of women. And of course, there will be people that hate this book. And I guarantee you, of you listening, the majority of you will probably not want to pick this up now that I've talked about it. But I thought it was really well done and really interesting in the topics that it actually manages to discuss. So I'm going to rate this a 4 out of 5. I think if you want to try something different, if you don't mind, you know, seeing some of this stuff, be a little more in your face, if you don't mind the gratuitous people getting eaten thing, then this might be one for you as well. But I love this kind of horror stuff. Horror with something to say. So I'm rating it a 4 out of 5. That's Juke Joint number 1 from Image Comics. All right, let's go to IDW and talk about Arkham Dreams. The Max Batman Arkham Dreams. This is written with art by Sam Keith and plotting assistance by John Layman. We've got colors by Rhonda Pattison and letters by Sean Lee. And, you know, here we go again with the who is this book for kind of thing. I'm going to tell you who this book is for. It's for me, because I know this won't be a hot seller. In fact, I would assume that a large chunk of people that enjoy Batman will absolutely hate this book. I can almost guarantee that. But if you are a fan of the Max, if you remember the Max, then you'll be right at home, as they say, in this book. Because this is very much a, you know, it didn't have to be Batman in this story. It could have been anybody. So it's very much a Max story. And it takes place, for sure, after the events of the original series, the Max series from the 90s. A series which I loved, for some reason, I still don't know why. There was a lot of oddness in the Max. But I really loved it. And you know what? To think about it a little bit, it may be one of the original, dealing with mental health issues kind of stories. because the Max is crazy AF. He is. He's crazy. Or is he? We don't know. And that's kind of what the story has always been about. Is this guy for real? Is the Outback a real place? Or is it something that he's imagining? Really interesting stuff. You know, that was played around a lot with the Max animated series that was on MTV after they quit showing so many music videos. Before they just became a reality TV channel. But, yeah, it's really interesting. You know, if you're a Sam Keith fan, it's the same kind of art style you've come to know and love. The coloring is a little bit different because it's a different colorist. I think he may have colored his own work when he was doing the original Max series. I don't take my word for that. I could be wrong. Somebody I'm sure will correct me. I get those every so often. But, yeah, so, you know, the cop, Max is in Gotham. The cops show up, a bunch of homeless dudes hanging around. The Max is there, talking about the Outback, and they're like, come on, buddy, you're coming with us. And for some reason, Batman's hanging out with the cops. They take him to Arkham, and there's this really weird professor. And when the professor came in, I realized the best way to read the story is to read it as if you were reading something from the 50s or early 60s, one of those Batman stories. You know what I'm talking about, the zany Haney stories, those kind of stories, because it almost reads like that. You know, if you read the doctor's voice in that like typical 50s bad guy mustache twirling villain kind of thing, kind of voice, then things start making a little more sense. Now, we don't know if the doctor's in on this, if he's a bad guy or a good guy. He seems to maybe be a bad guy, but quite unsure yet, because there is a lot of breaking in and out of the Outback. And the Outback that we see in this particular book is not necessarily the Max's Outback. It may be Batman's Outback or somebody else's. There's some hints that maybe some of the prisoners in Arkham are using the Max's Outback to escape and try to inflict some damage on our reality through the Outback. None of that's explicitly mentioned. I know at the end the Penguin shows up. But aside from that, we don't really know. And, you know, this is only a miniseries, I think 4 or 5 issues. But, man, it really makes me wish that the Max was back with another volume, with brand new stories. So while this may not be a book for you, in fact, if you're a Batman fan, you probably want to skip this one. I really do recommend it. It's 4 out of 5 for me. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Let's go over to Dynamite and talk about the Lone Ranger number one. I would never in my life have guessed that I would be talking about a Lone Ranger comic or let alone reading one, but I did and it was fantastic. Lone Ranger number one, written by Mark Russell, who of course I love from his work on the Flintstones and the Porky Pig Lex Luthor thing. Art and covers by Bob Q, who I'm not familiar with, but I really dug the art style, and letters by Hassan Osmani Elhu, who does the panel-by-panel digital-only magazine that I talked about on this podcast many times. There's a brand-new issue out that just came out on, just within the next couple of weeks, on The Incredible Hulk. I recommend you check out this magazine. It's like $2.50 an issue. Really great breakdowns. If you're a comic fan, if you're a comic reviewer, if you're a comic creator, then this magazine is a must, I think. I love it. I love it. All right, so Lone Ranger number one. I mean, kind of typical Lone Ranger story. It does take place, you know, back in the day. It takes place in Texas, and a story that's very much typical, I would say, for the Lone Ranger. But of course, this is Mark Russell, so there is a little bit of social commentary thrown in. Not overly overt though, but really interesting. The there's you know, I guess we can call them robber barons in Texas that are trying to carve up the land. They're killing ranchers around the state to try to expand their own territory. And this guy is trying to run for Senate, and he's going to use his power when he gets to Senate to create these bills that will basically allow anybody within the borders of Texas to claim somebody else's land. And by anybody, I mean these rich people who will be supporting his Senate campaign, to pretty much write whatever rules they want, in terms of property ownership. And it'll be retroactive. So even if you didn't own that land before, if you feel like you wanted to rewrite the borders, then you'd be more than able to do so, because it would be your right. And it would be backed by the federal government. So that's pretty interesting, right? We don't have, of course, that kind of thing with property ownership nowadays. But there's a lot of talk on this on, like, for example, voting territories. You know, we have an election coming up. Really interesting stuff. The Lone Ranger does show up. We get to learn a little bit about his backstory as well. You know, he frees some of these ranchers that are about to get killed. But we do learn what happened to him. There were five other rangers. And these barons ended up killing all of them. They thought he was dead. They had already dug graves for him. They were underground. And he managed to somehow claw his way out from the dirt. And now he's out kind of for revenge to right the wrongs of what happened to his other rangers. But he's by himself. And he knows this is not going to be an easy thing to do, to take on these really powerful men in Texas. So he goes to try to enlist the help of Tonto, who he and Tonto have had a falling out, because Tonto rescued him from, you know, from this grave. And as a result, they went out to war with these barons, and the barons burned down Tonto's village. And so Tonto's like, I'm done with you. You know, we're not going to be doing this anymore. But he goes and says, hey, look, I know what happened. You don't want to see me anymore, but I really need your help, because we've got a lot going on. And Tonto's like, okay, you need help in a war, you know, count me in. So that was cool to see. I really enjoyed this. I haven't seen a Lone Ranger TV show in, I don't even know how long. I must have been like 5 or 6 the last time I watched the Lone Ranger. But it really had me calling back to that kind of stuff. I loved the Lone Ranger back then. And I'm definitely going to be in on this one as well. 4 out of 5, Lone Ranger #1 from Dynamite Comics. The final book of the week is going to be Death Orb #1. This one is from Dark Horse Comics. It is written by Ryan Ferrier, with art by Alejandro Aragon, colors by Chris O'Halloran, letters by Ryan Ferrier, cover by Alejandro Aragon, and the original story is by Alejandro and Ryan. So that's cool. This is also a post-apocalyptic book, but one that I found really fascinating, because this world is a mishmash of many different things. Many different things. We don't know how the world got here, right? This has already been happening for quite a while, unlike Lodord West, which we talked about at the beginning of the episode. And things are really weird. You know, the country has been taken over by this, seems like, religious cult. They're called a divination. And different parts of the country are ruled by different lords. And our main character is out to try to find his wife, who is pregnant and has disappeared. And he feels like they may know who has his wife. So he's out to try to find her. He meets a lot of unsavory characters in the meantime. In fact, one is super creepy. He goes into a bar and kills these guys. And the bartender's like, you gotta get the hell out of here, dude. When that happens, this blind man comes in, who has some psychic abilities, it seems. And he ends up taking care of him and the henchmen. As we learn, he cuts the guy's head off, and he's riding around the country with the dude's head in his backpack. So that happened. And he rides around in a motorcycle, so it's very Mad Max-y in that regards. But, you know, one thing that really does this book really well is that the art style is beautiful. Beautiful, and so kinetic as well. There's some really fantastically choreographed fight scenes in here. And I know that's sometimes difficult to do in a comic book, because you're not seeing the action in between. You're getting bits and pieces of it, but really, really awesome. So this guy's out to try to find where his wife is. And we learn a lot about the world. We learn that there's something going on with the divination. They're trying to perfect humanity in some way. So in their eyes, they're not necessarily bad, because they're trying to save humanity from the calamities that are going on in the world. And it seems like there's some kind of big event that's going to happen that will cause whatever's left of mankind to be wiped out. And so the divination's trying to do these experiments on people to try to prevent that from happening. Really, really cool. There's, you know, it's a book that's really hard to explain, because there's so much happening. And the other cool thing is, you know, there's a lot of high tech stuff, but it's not a high tech world. I don't know if that makes a lot of sense. It very much reads like a Western, and many of the scenes could really be taken straight out of a Western. But like when the character goes into the cities, there's, you know, like jumbotrons everywhere with the divination priest talking about certain things. There's security guards that have high tech weaponry on them as well. And, really, really cool. The main character, I don't know if he is also enhanced, because at one point he's being followed by these guys who were hired by the divination to take him out. And he almost has like a spider sense and like jumps out of his bike. And like, I know it's a comic, but I mean, this dude jumps high, man. Really high. But, yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome. It reminds me of a few different books, like Seven to Eternity, if you ever read that. It's got that kind of feel to it as well. And, you know, I love that book. I don't know what happened to it. Or, what was the other one? Tokyo Ghost, similar in style to that as well. A little, you know what? Now that I think about it, a lot of this reminds me of Akira in the way that the atmosphere is set up. And if you're not an anime or manga guy, you may not know Akira, but I mean, I think everyone knows Akira, right? Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm just imagining. At the end of the book, our main character gets shot in the head and appears to be dead. That is a spoiler, but let me tell you, I'm sure it's not going to stick because this is only the first issue and this book follows the story of this guy. So I'm sure there'll be some kind of maybe supernatural-ish thing going on as well. Really, really dug it. Really dug it. It's a 5 out of 5 for me on Death Orb number 1. I cannot wait to pick up the next one. That is going to wrap up this episode of Comic Talk Today, though. Thank you all for listening. I know yesterday I had Joey on. We talked about the Titans TV show. So if you don't want to spoil, check that episode out and see what you think about the discussion. Maybe it'll help you decide whether you want to do DC Universe or not in order to check out the show. But spoiler alert, we both really loved it. In fact, Aaron Bell from the Absolute DC podcast, known to hate many a thing, really loved it. So I recommend you check that episode out. Tomorrow's episode, it'll be a topic. It'll be a topic. I'll be talking about Chuck Wendig's firing from the Star Wars books and why that's important to the comic book industry as a whole. If you don't know anything about that, I'll fill you in on tomorrow's episode, but it's a kind of sad state of affairs, in my opinion. Tuesday, I'll be back with Top of the Pile, so I'll catch up on this past week's books, and then got a few couple other things planned out for the rest of the week. So, episode-filled week of Comic Talk Today this week. I hope you enjoyed it. Get in touch with me on Twitter, at Geekvine. Email is yell@comictalk.today. I love that email address. I really do. I'm so stupid, but I do. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you on the next one.